Well, thank you. And it's an honour to be here, especially as the first Archie Roy speaker in this newly named series. He was a wonderful man and a great inspiration to people all over the world, not just here in Scotland. It's also a pleasure to be here on May Day. I have travelled up this afternoon from London, and it's wonderful going through the English and Scottish countryside on May Day, mostly in the sun. It did start raining the minute we crossed the border, but it was just seeing the vegetation bursting forth and the blossoms. So it's a lovely day to be here. Now, I'm talking about the science delusion, the title of my recent book. And what the science delusion is the belief that science has already understood the nature of reality in principle, leaving only the details to be filled in. There are a lot of people who believe that. And what it means is that it creates a tremendous atmosphere of self-congratulation. You know, people used to think that, but we now know life is genetically programmed, we know the structure of DNA, etc. It leads to an attitude that we've almost got it all figured out, and there's no real mysteries left. And things that might be mysteries, like psychical research, aren't really mysteries at all because they don't exist, or at least the phenomena don't exist. That's the attitude that we often find among people who say, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. The kind of people who've made science into a kind of religion. Now, I'm totally pro-science. I spent my whole career as a research scientist. So I think science is a wonderful method of investigation. It's the best we have. Through hypothesis, through gathering evidence, through critical discussion. So as a method, science is progressive and enormously effective. But I think there's a crisis in the heart of modern science because that method, that free inquiry, that is the lifeblood of science, is being stifled by a terrible dogmatism which has been dominating the sciences since the late 19th century. Around that time, all the sciences came under the influence of the philosophy of materialism, which is a worldview or philosophy. Many people believe in it. And it's basically a philosophical worldview. It's not science, it's a kind of metaphysical system. But when it dominates science, it imposes a kind of straitjacket of what you can think and what you can't think. This straitjacket has now become extremely restrictive in every area of science. And what I do in this book is take the 10 dogmas of materialism, assumptions, and turn them into questions and look at them scientifically. If we treat these not as truths, but as hypotheses, how well do they square up to the evidence? If we look at them as if they're not given facts, but things we can inquire about, how well do they do? It turns out none of them do very well. And as soon as you're free to question these dogmas, and as soon as you're free to look at the bigger picture without being constrained by them, in every area, science opens up, new experiments become possible. And I think that this process of questioning these foundational assumptions could regenerate all the sciences, not just psychology and parapsychology and psychical research. So my theme this evening is rather bigger than the sphere of psychical research, but it does bear upon it, because the reason the deep prejudices in our culture exist is largely because of this philosophy of materialism. It's a philosophy that basically says psychic phenomena are impossible. So if people like us come up with evidence saying they seem to exist, it's much easier to say we're deluded or the experiments must be flawed than to think the materialist worldview might be challenged. And that's why we come up against such completely irrational prejudice in relation to our subject, and why parapsychology and psychical research are still the Cinderella of the sciences. Okay, well, what I'm going to do first is run through these 10 dogmas, and then I'll look at two or three of them in more detail. I haven't time to address all 10 this evening. The first of the 10 dogmas was the foundation of modern science in the 17th century. Nature is mechanical. Nature is machine-like. Everything in nature is machinery. Animals are machines, plants are machines, we're machines. In Richard Dawkins' vivid phrase, we are lumbering robots. The universe is a machine. Animals and plants are machines, that's why we can grow them in factory farms and in industrial agriculture. They're just machinery, and farms are like factories in this conception. In the 17th century, this was quite a liberating assumption, because before that, people thought that nature was alive, and it restricted the kinds of quantitative research people could do. Before the 17th century, people thought the world was like an organism. The earth was an organism, Mother Earth. Animals and plants were organisms with souls. The word animal, of course, comes from the Latin word anima, meaning soul. Humans had souls, but we weren't unique. All living things had souls, including the earth. So this was the worldview that was overturned, and the point about machines and what makes them different from organisms is they don't organise themselves, which organisms do. Machines have to be made in factories. And they don't design themselves because they have to have engineers to design them. And they don't have their own purposes, which organisms do. Machines have no purposes of their own. And in the 17th century, people thought that God was the designer, and humans and God were the only purposes, had the only purposes in nature. But machines and the whole of nature had no purpose of its own, no value, no feeling, no thought, no intelligence. You see the difference when you, if you get in a car, you can go wherever you want as long as the car's working. It doesn't have any desire of its own. But if you get on a horse, it might have its own ideas about what it wants to do, but that's because it's an organism, not a machine. Anyway, that was the foundational assumption of science in the 17th century. The second assumption follows from it: matter is unconscious. The whole universe is made up of unconscious matter. Atoms, molecules, animals, plants, human bodies, they're all unconscious. Third assumption: the laws of nature are fixed. They're the same today as they were at the moment of the Big Bang, and they'll be the same forever. And the constants are fixed as well. Fourth assumption, the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. This is the principle of conservation of matter and energy we all learned at school, and seems so well established that it may seem crazy to even question it. But I'll come back to that one in a minute. Fifth assumption, nature is purposeless. The universe is a machine, everything in it's a machine, therefore there's no purpose in nature. Evolution has no purpose or direction, it's just propelled by blind chance and the impersonal, unconscious forces of natural selection. The whole universe is pointless, it's going nowhere. Assumption six, biological inheritance is material. Everything you inherit biologically is in the genes, genetic material, or epigenetic modifications of the genes, or cytoplasmic inheritance, but at any rate, it's all material. Assumption seven, memories are stored inside the brain as material traces. Everything you remember is somewhere inside your head, either as phosphorylated proteins or modified nerve endings or in some other material form. Dogma eight, the mind is inside the head. The mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. It's all inside your head. That's all there is to it. Dogma 9, which follows from Dogma 8, psychic phenomena are illusory. Things like telepathy can't possibly happen because the mind's confined to the inside of the head, so your thoughts or intentions can't possibly have an effect at a distance. People may appear to have these experiences, but that's just because it's coincidence, or wishful thinking, or flawed experiments, or fraud. But it's impossible. So you know in advance that these things are impossible because the mind's inside the head and completely confined to the head. This is the main reason that so-called skeptics are so dismissive of psychic phenomena, because they know in advance they can't possibly happen. They're impossible. And dogma 10... is that mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. Alternative and complementary medicine may appear to work, But that's just because people would have got better anyway, or it's all the placebo effect. But the only kind that really works is mechanistic medicine that depends on chemistry, drugs, or surgery, physical treatment. And of course, drugs and surgery are very helpful. But are they the whole picture? Well, I don't think so. Most people don't think so. But that's the official dogma. Mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. And that's why the British Medical Research Council spends about £600 or £700 million a year on research, and not a penny of it goes to complementary or alternative medicine, because it'd be a waste of money, because they're all quacks. That's the basic assumption, underlying official thinking. And these assumptions, these 10 dogmas, are the default position of most educated people today, not just scientists, but people with arts degrees too, who feel they've got to go along with this scientific worldview, because they're modern people and they don't want to be thought stupid or uneducated. So this is the official default worldview of the educational establishment, governments, companies, corporations, the media. It's just the standard modern view. But every one of these dogmas is highly questionable and, in fact, has been superseded by the advances of science itself. At the leading edge of every branch of science, there are people who know that the standard assumptions are not all there is to it. They wouldn't be doing research if they already knew the answers. But they think it's just their area that's uncertain. And say they're in the middle of cosmology. They know there are doubt questions in cosmology, but they assume that biologists have got it all right about memory and inheritance and stuff. They don't question those. They may question one particular area, but not the others. So I'm not saying all scientists believe all these dogmas absolutely. They don't. They're at the leading edge in each area. There are people who question them. But the news hasn't sort of got out to people in the other parts of science, or certainly not outside the scientific world. I'm going to start by looking at the assumption I myself thought was the most certain of all. The total amount of matter and energy is always the same. I learned it at school like you did. The principle of conservation of matter and energy seems absolutely certain. And when I was writing this book, this was the one dogma I hadn't actually questioned. I thought I ought to question it as one of the standard assumptions. I quite wanted it to turn out to be true. I thought if all 10 dogmas turned out to be false, it might sound as if I was biased. I thought it would be quite good if one of them was true. And I thought this was the best candidate. But when I looked into it, I realised it was actually one of the shakiest of them all. First of all, you might imagine that people believe this because it was proved to many places of decimals by very accurate experiments. Not so. It was an assumption built into science in the 17th century, right from the outset, and the reasons for doing it were theological, not scientific. In the 17th century machine worldview, the idea was that God created the world machine in the first place, and he created all the atoms in nature, and created all the movement or energy that makes things move. And those were endowed, nature was endowed with these things right at the outset. So the total amount of matter, the number of atoms, was fixed after the beginning, after the creation. The atoms were indestructible by definition, so the total number stayed the same. And the total amount of motion, force, or energy remained the same. Now these were codified in the 19th century, in the 1850s, the law of conservation of energy is the first law of thermodynamics, 1851. And this seemed to be a complete triumph of physics, and everything seemed absolutely certain. And for accountancy purposes within physics and chemistry experiments, these principles work quite well. But are they the truth about nature? Most of us assume they must be, but physicists are much freer when it comes to tampering with the laws of nature. After all, they basically make them up. And so they can, they're much freer with these things. And in the 1980s, it turned out that stars were moving too fast around the centres of galaxies to be explained by conventional physics. And galaxies were attracting each other too much. So either the laws of gravitation and our understanding of astronomy was severely flawed, or there must be a lot more matter in galaxies than anyone had ever thought. So what they did, they added up all the matter in the stars, gas clouds, made a generous allowance for planets and things. There just wasn't enough to explain the behaviour of the galaxies. So how did they solve this problem? Well, some physicists said, well, maybe the laws need changing, or some. Others said, no, it just proves that there's much more matter than we ever thought. There's a lot of extra matter we didn't know about before. It's called dark matter, because we can't see it. So they hypothesized dark matter, about 5 times more than the amount of regular matter. Well, there's no independent evidence for dark matter, except that it explains the behavior of galaxies in terms of conventional physics. So how much dark matter is there? Well, just the amount you need to make the equations balance. You can titrate in as much dark matter as you need, and that's the amount there is. And if the observations change and you notice a galaxy is behaving in some weird way, you can add in more dark matter wherever you want. And it works perfectly. Physics is absolutely perfect. The equations are flawless. They explain everything, because you can adjust the amount of dark matter at will. But we don't know what it is or how it works. They've spent 20 or 30 years trying to find out, and nobody knows even today. Does it really exist? Well, it must do, because it makes the equations balance. Is the total amount of dark matter always the same? It's matter, after all. Well, who knows? No one had heard of it till 30 years ago, and suddenly the amount of matter in the universe increased fivefold at the stroke of a pen. What about the conservation of matter? If physicists can create 5 times more as a hypothesis, then is dark matter conserved? Is it always the same? Nobody knows. The amounts keep changing, because whenever they make new observations, they can change the amount of dark matter. One of the consequences of introducing all this dark matter is that it meant there was much more matter in the universe than anyone had previously assumed. And as you know, the universe is thought to be expanding. If you increase the amount of matter in the universe, the amount of gravity in the universe becomes greater, and that should slow down the expansion. And according to this theory, the normal theory in the 1990s, it should stop expanding and then begin to contract under the influence of gravity until it ends in the opposite of the Big Bang, called the Big Crunch. But in the late 1990s, they discovered that the universe is not slowing down in its expansion, it's speeding up. So how can you possibly explain that? Well, the answer is there must be another form of energy pushing it apart. What's it called? It's called dark energy, because we can't see it or observe it in any other way. The total amount of dark matter and dark energy is now believed to be 96% of reality. The matter and energy you learned about at school, which is supposed to be conserved, is only 4% of what there is. Is the rest of it conserved? Is it always the same? Well, actually, no. The total amount of dark energy is increasing as the universe expands. The universe is now a perpetual motion machine. Now, some physicists would say, well, it's not really increasing because it's offset by changes in the density of space or something like that. But in terms of dark energy, it is increasing. So what about the laws of conservation of matter and energy? What seemed like an absolutely certain fact beyond question turns out to be a very questionable assumption in the midst of a vast quantity of unknown matter and energy whose nature is literally obscure. In addition, in quantum theory, it's now believed that the matter that we know about, matter like us in this room, is like waves on the ocean of a vast quantity of energy in the quantum vacuum field, which is not empty but full of energy. There's enough in a teaspoon to power Scotland for years. There's huge quantities of energy in the so-called vacuum. The particles we know about, the matter we know about, are like waves on the surface of an ocean of energy. So some people have not unreasonably asked, well, could we tap it? If we could, there'd be no need for all energy crises, global warming and that kind of thing. We could have a completely new kind of economy. Indeed, there are people who claim to have developed machines that do tap it. They produce more energy than you put into them. Now, as soon as they do this, they run into another of those scientific taboos based on the law of conservation of energy. It's the oldest taboo in science, actually. It was established by Galileo in about 1610. the taboo against perpetual motion machines. So when inventors come up with these devices, and there are a lot of them around, they're called above unity or free energy devices. They don't usually claim to be making energy, they usually claim to be tapping it from the quantum vacuum field or from other sources. Do people jump up and down and say, that's great, that's fantastic? No, they don't. They say these people are complete cranks, you know, they must be kept out of science, don't touch them with a barge pole, governments or investors, because they're obviously wrong, what they're saying is impossible. This is one of the areas where these taboos in science are seriously holding us back. My answer to that problem would be to have an international prize, say $1 million, for the best above unity machine, and test the various existing devices in an open-minded way to see if any of them really work. I don't know if they really work or not. I'd like to find out. And I think a prize would be a good way of doing it. And I think as well as the prize, we could also ask commercial bookmakers to open a book on it. People could then put their money where their mouth is. Those who say it's completely impossible could bet their house and hundreds of thousands of pounds on no one winning the prize. I'd be prepared to bet a few thousand that it is possible. Not more than a few thousand, and I'd put in a few thousand, I think. And I think bets are actually a really good way of quantifying what people's opinions are. I've noticed this with scientists. When they can apply for grants for millions of pounds to do something, in the grant proposal it says this will lead to a cure for cancer or whatever, when you ask them to put their own money on a bet as to whether this will happen, I find they're very often reluctant to part with a few hundred pounds to sustain claims that, for which they're getting millions in grants. Anyway, so I think in relation to energy, that would be one way forward. I think it's a completely open question. Interestingly, Brian Josephson, the Nobel laureate in physics, who's very friendly to psychical research and indeed it helps in the world of psychical research, is himself a defender of these people who are unjustly persecuted because they claim they've got above unity devices. He's completely open-minded about it and thinks they're perfectly possible. And I've heard sceptics denounce Brian Josephson saying, you know, this guy's a charlatan, he's claiming quantum physics can explain these things. These people know nothing about physics, where he's got a Nobel Prize in quantum physics. He thinks these things are perfectly possible and that there's something going on. He's looked at the evidence that's really not understood. Okay, well, I'm going to turn now to the assumption that matter's unconscious, which is the second assumption I mentioned. Universe is a machine, matter's unconscious. Now, how do we come to this assumption? If you look at the history, you see again that this is not something that was established by careful experiment and discussion. It was simply assumed in the 17th century. The French philosopher Descartes said that nature is a machine and is made of unconscious matter. And Descartes was the philosopher who gave us the famous Cartesian dualism named after him. He said matter by definition is unconscious. It's extended in space and it's totally unconscious. Minds, by definition, are not extended in space or time. They're outside space and time, and they're conscious, and they're immaterial. And minds are confined to God, angels, and human beings. Now, the human mind somehow interacts with the machinery of the brain in a small region of the brain. He thought it was the pineal gland. Modern forms of dualism are similar, except the supposed seat of interaction shifted a couple of inches into the cerebral cortex. But Descartes then created this extreme dualism. Matter was defined as unconscious. And it created an extreme duality between mind and body, between people and animals, because animals didn't have minds, rational thinking minds. They were just machines. So we could vivisect them, exploit them, do what we like to animals. They're just machines. And it created a split between science and religion. Religion got the human spirit, angels and God, and morality. And science got the whole of nature, including the human body. And it kept these two spheres apart and reducing conflict for much of the history of science. By the 19th century, many people didn't like this kind of dualism. They thought there should just be one thing, not two things. Personally, I think two is too few, not too many. I think we need at least three ultimate principles, a kind of Trinitarian approach. But anyway, most people thought it would be better to have one rather than two. One school of thought, the idealist, said there's only one reality, it's mind or spirit. Matter is nothing but kind of dumbed down mind. That's the philosophical tradition of idealism. Everything's mind. The other option was to say, no, mind doesn't exist, it's just matter. Matter's the only reality. And that is, by definition, the philosophy of materialism, that says that matter's the only reality. The mind is nothing but an aspect of matter. At one stroke, materialism got rid of angels and God, so it's essentially atheistic. And they then had the only mind left were human minds, somehow arising from the activity of human brains. That's how we get to the idea the mind's nothing but the brain. It's materialism chopping off one pole of dualism and retaining the assumption that dualism had built into it from Descartes onwards that matter's unconscious. But of course, it leads to an immediate and obvious problem. If matter's unconscious and we're undeniably conscious, how come we have minds at all? Well, the best way to deal with that from materialists is to say we don't have minds, we're not conscious, we're just machines like everything else. And the behaviourist school in psychology, which dominated the English-speaking world in the 20th century, explicitly dismissed consciousness as being of any scientific value. It said it's just an illusion, a concept invented to confuse, whereas the job of science is to study objective phenomena, muscular movements and glandular secretions, leaving the mind totally out of psychology. Amazingly, that dominated for decades the academic departments of psychology in Britain and elsewhere. Meanwhile, philosophers of mind have spent a lot of time and energy trying to deny that we're conscious. The mind is nothing but an illusion. The mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. To talk in terms of minds and feelings is just folk psychology that will be swept away by the advance of neuroscience. Many materialist philosophers argue for different brands of this materialist doctrine, even today. I went to a debate in London about a month ago between Nicholas Humphrey, a materialist psychologist, and Daniel Dennett, a materialist philosopher, about the nature of the mind. And both of them agreed the mind was nothing but the activity of the brain. But then they had to explain consciousness, and Dennett said it's an illusion. It doesn't really exist, it's an illusion. And Humphrey said it's not an illusion, it's the appearance of an illusion. And the debate was about the distinction, which none of us could grasp, between the appearance of an illusion and an illusion. The trouble is that saying it's illusion doesn't solve it, because illusion itself is a mode of consciousness. It presupposes consciousness. So materialism is in deep trouble. And until recently, consciousness studies was kept out of science altogether. But for the last 15 or 20 years, it's become a scientific area of inquiry, and it's now one of the most exciting in science. It's completely changed the context for this debate. Several materialists are now jumping ship. A few years ago, Galen Strawson, a British materialist, wrote a paper called "Does Materialism Imply Panpsychism?" And he argued that it's incoherent to say that consciousness can emerge from totally unconscious matter, like a light bulb switching on in human brains at a certain stage in evolution, or animal brains. That the only way you can account for consciousness is by assuming there's some kind of mental activity, even in electrons and atoms, that some mind-like aspect runs through all nature. That is traditionally the doctrine of panpsychism. Pan meaning everywhere, psychism meaning psyche or soul. In everything. The leading American philosopher of mind, Thomas Nagel, published a book a few months ago that caused outrage and shockwaves in the academic world, called Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. He's now abandoned materialism and is arguing openly for panpsychism. He's an atheist. He's not doing this because he has some ulterior religious motive or anything, but he just thinks it's the only reasonable philosophy. Now, of course, panpsychism is not a new philosophy. It was put forward, it was most of the Middle Ages believed in it, and in the 17th century, after Descartes, it was advocated by the philosopher Leibniz, who said nature's made up of monads, units of organisation, including us, and each monad has both a body and a mind, and each monad reflects the whole universe from its own point of view. So the entire universe is made up of conscious, perceiving beings, all of them reflecting the universe from their own point of view. Spinoza said that nature is the body of God and God is the mind of nature. So again, there's a kind of mind and body, which are two aspects of the same thing. Right through nature. The 20th century saw probably the greatest panpsychic philosophers in the form of Alfred North Whitehead. Whitehead was a mathematician as well as a philosopher, and he was one of the first philosophers to realise the importance of quantum theory. Quantum theory tells us that matter is not made up of hard little billiard ball-like atoms. It's made up of wave-like processes. An electron isn't a thing, it's a wave, a vibratory pattern of energy in an electron field. And an atom is a vibratory pattern of activity. So matter isn't stuff. Matter is process. And so Whitehead pointed out that if a wave is the basis of an electron or everything else, then the wave has to have time within it. It has to have a past pole and a future pole, because a wave takes time. You can't have an instantaneous wave in an instant, because it takes time to wave. And and because it's spread out in space, you can't have it an instant in space, at a point in space. That's the ultimate reason for the uncertainty principle in quantum mechanics, that matter's made of waves. Now, if matter's made of waves, and waves have a future and a past pole, all substance is actually a process, and process has time within it. Now, Whitehead used this insight to come up with what I think is the most interesting way of looking at the mind-body problem. He pointed out that everything has a mental pole and a physical pole. The mental pole is the future pole, the physical pole is the past pole. The future pole is concerned with what might happen next with possibilities. An electron, according to quantum theory, when you're dealing with what's going to happen next, has a wave equation which tells you all the possible things it could do. When it does something, when it interacts, all these possibilities collapse down to one observable fact, which is now in the past. It's called the collapse of the wave function sometimes. Possibilities are many, but not material yet. As soon as there's a decision, then they become material. That's in the past, and again, a new set of possibilities open up. We're like that too. Our minds are largely concerned with possibilities. Our conscious minds are arenas of possibility. In our conscious minds, we entertain coexisting possibilities, and one of the main functions of our minds is to choose between those possibilities. Like, for example, we're all here this evening. This is an observable scientific fact. We can be photographed, weighed, measured, etc. in this room. But before we came here, we could have done many other things this evening. There was a whole range of possibilities among which we chose. We chose to come here. Now it's an observable fact. But before we chose, there were other alternatives, and our conscious minds were involved in making a choice among them. And as soon as you make the choice and make it come true, then the choice becomes a fact. Anyway, I think this idea of seeing the mind as concerned with virtual futures, with a causal influence that works from the future towards the past, and the body and physical reality as having a causal influence that works from the past towards the future through regular energy and physical causation, this gives us a picture of mental and physical causations overlapping in the present, moving, as it were, in opposite directions. I think this is a much more interesting way of thinking of the mind-body problem than the usual way, which is based on a spatial metaphor. The mind's inside, the body's outside, the inner life, the external world. It's spatial, but a Whitehead, I think, is much, much more fruitful as a source of thinking about it. It's actually a relation in time, not space. Now, I want to come on now to another dogma to do with the mind. The mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. It's all inside the head. This is, of course, a standard part of materialism. Matter is the ultimate reality. Thinking seems to happen inside the head. Therefore, the mind is the brain. Therefore, the neurosciences have a huge prestige at the moment. You know, if people look at anything to do with the mind, the first thing people say, well, where is it in the brain? They want a scanning picture to prove it's in the brain. Most people aren't in the slightest interest as where it really is. I mean, even if you tell them, they forget it within 30 seconds. But somehow you can hang on to it as being real if you can show some kind of scan. You know, people say to me, well, if telepathy is real, where is it in the brain? If I said to them, oh, well, fMRI studies have shown that such a region lights up, they'd be perfectly happy. They wouldn't want to know any details. It would somehow prove it's real. This is part of this clutching at the materialist straw. They've got to say it's in the brain. Well, no doubt these things do interact with things in the brain, but it doesn't prove they're nothing but the brain. But the assumption it's all in the brain is based on old-fashioned view of matter. Since the 1840s, we've thought of matter as being made up not just of stuff, which is the pre-19th century view of matter, but as having extended fields of influence. Faraday first discovered fields, or first named fields, in the 1840s, studying electrical and magnetic fields. In a magnet, for example, the field of the magnet's inside the magnet and stretches out invisibly beyond it. That's why it can cause patterns in iron filings, lines of force, why magnets can repel or attract each other at a distance. The gravitational field of the Earth is inside the Earth and stretches far beyond it, keeps the moon in its orbit. The field of your mobile telephone is an electromagnetic field inside the telephone and stretching out invisibly far beyond it. What I'm suggesting is that the fields of our minds are inside our brains and stretch out beyond them. You see, until now, we've had two choices. The mind is nothing but the brain inside the head. Or, in Cartesian dualism, the mind is totally immaterial, not in space and time at all. And it's utterly mysterious as how it could actually be influencing and being influenced by the brain, because they're of totally different natures. I'm suggesting a third way. It's not either the mind, nothing but the brain, or it's hardly anything to do with the brain, it's so immaterial. I'm suggesting a third approach, that the mind is linked into a set of fields that are in and beyond the brain, that stretch out beyond the brain, that our minds are not confined to the insides of our heads. The easiest way to understand this is by thinking of vision. What happens when you see something, like you're seeing me now? The standard view is well known to everyone. Light's reflected from me, passes through the electromagnetic field, enters your eyes, goes through the lens, inverted images on your retinas, changes in the cone cells, impulses up the optic nerves, and activity in various regions of the brain. So far, so good. And we know more detail than we've ever known before. But does that explain vision? Well, no, first of all, it doesn't explain the fact you're conscious. That's not explained at all by science. In fact, this problem of the very existence of consciousness in the philosophy of mind is called the hard problem, because no one knows how to explain the fact we're conscious at all. So the fact you're conscious of what you're seeing is unexplained. But I'm going to move to the second but less appreciated problem as to where are these images that you're seeing. The standard view is that the impulses lead to patterns of activity in the brain, and everything you see is then inside your head. Your mind's inside your head. All your experience is inside your head. Somehow, this activity in the nervous system leads you to create a three-dimensional coloured virtual reality display inside your head. And that virtual reality display right now includes an image of me and of everything else in this room. But that's all inside your head. It's a representation inside your head. If you look at the sky as you look at it is inside your head too. The sky you're seeing is in your head. There was a paper recently in one of the leading consciousness journals called Is Your Skull Beyond the Sky? And the author, a materialist philosopher, said, yes, of course it is. All your experience is in your brain. This is only a virtual skull created as part of your perceptual world. All your experience is inside your head. Your skull is beyond the sky. Well, that is the official standard view taken to its logical conclusion. When you do that, it seems shocking and really very weird. Most people don't think it through. They just take it as must be true, and they don't think about it. When you think about it, it's very, very weird indeed. The alternative, which I'm suggesting now, is so simple it's hard to grasp. The images you're seeing are exactly where they seem to be. Your image of me is right here. It's not inside your brain, it's outside your brain, but it's in your mind. It's a mentally constructed image, but it's projected out to where it seems to be. I think our whole perceptual world is projected out to where it seems to be. Vision involves light coming into the eyes and the outward projection of images. Normally, these images coincide with where things are. Sometimes they don't, then it's an illusion or a hallucination. But I'm suggesting that even in every simple act of perception, our minds stretch out beyond our brains. Not just our minds, but animal minds, anything with image-forming eyes. The world is full of invisible projections of minds, just as it's full of invisible radio waves, TV waves, mobile phone waves, and so on. So I think this is all projected out. It's not a new theory. This is what Plato believed. It's what the ancient Greeks believed. It's what people all over the world believe. It's what Hindu and Buddhist philosophers believe. It's what most of us believed till we were 10 or 11. The developmental psychologist Jean Piaget showed that until the age of 10 or 11, the average European child believes that vision involves an outward projection of images as well as light coming in. That's why Superman comics have rays going out of the eyes. And there's a Roald Dahl story about a girl who has rays coming out of her eyes that she can move things with. Children think like that, but by the age of 10 or 11, Piaget said, they learn the correct view, which is that thoughts and images are invisible things located inside the head. Now, they take that on trust. We all took it on trust. No one's ever seen a thought or an image inside a head. And this is a very eccentric view in the context of human, if you look at all across humanity. Hardly anyone believes this except people who have been scientifically educated. And yet, there's no evidence for it at all. Now, I'm a scientist, not a philosopher, so I want to test this. And when I got interested in this question, I thought, well, if the mind reaches out through fields to touch what it's looking at, could you affect something by looking at it? Now, obviously, if someone sees you looking at them, then that's not a mystery, it's ordinary psychology. But what if you look at somebody from behind and they don't know you're there? Could they feel your gaze? Now, as soon as you ask that, you realize that most people have had this experience. It's extremely common. Surveys show about 90% of people have had, more than 90%, have had the feeling being looked at from behind. You turn around, someone's looking at you. Or you look at someone else and make them turn around. Now, this is where there is a sex difference in this. More women than men have experienced being stared at. More men than women have experienced making other people turn around by staring at them. But it's very common in both sexes and in children as well as grown-ups. When I realised the importance of this, the fact it's incredibly common, I looked in the scientific literature. What do we know about this? Between 1890 and 1985, there were 4 published papers on this subject. That's all. The whole world literature. The first 2 were written by sceptics around the turn of the 20th century. And they just said it's a superstition, it doesn't really exist, we tried it out on students and it didn't work, you know, with the professor staring at them in front of the class trying to prove that it doesn't work, proved it didn't work. And that was that. There were 2 other unpublished studies, one done in Edinburgh by a student of John Beloff's, which showed it did work. But there was no one made anything of it. It was just sort of buried. I started working on this in the 1990s, well, in the late 80s. One of the things I did was interview experts, people who look at others for a living, surveillance personnel, security guards, private detectives, store detectives. They all take it for granted. They all know this happens. It's just part of their work. They don't have any doubt about it. In martial arts, it's taken for granted, and you can train to increase your sensitivity to being looked at from behind, knowing who's looking at you from where. Useful thing to know. I started doing very simple experiments on this. I set them up. They've now been replicated worldwide with They're so simple a child can do them, and in fact thousands of children already have done them in schools in Britain, Germany and America. You look at someone, the subject is blindfolded, someone else sits behind them and either looks or doesn't look in a randomised series of trials. And you have to guess in each trial if you're being looked at or not. There's a signal from a click or a beep. These have given very significantly above chance results. And this experiment's now been running in the Amsterdam Science Museum for 20 years with staggeringly significant results, showing that the most sensitive subjects are children under the age of 9. That's also my own observation. People have done these through windows, through one-way mirrors, even through CCTV. Surprisingly, this even works through closed-circuit television. You measure people's skin resistance, and it changes. They're emotionally affected by being looked at on a screen by someone in another room. Now, this has been widely replicated. Richard Wiseman, the noted skeptic, did this experiment with his students, and it worked. He was astonished. He thought there must be a flaw. He assumed there must be a statistical artifact. So he did the experiment again. He did the looking himself. When he did the looking, it didn't work. But when he was interviewed by Caroline Watt after this, he said, "Oh, well, I didn't look very hard. It was so boring because I knew the completely pointless experiment." So it's very easy to see how you could get a non-significant result. But he did some joint experiments with Marilyn Schlitz, who of the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And in the same experiment in his lab, hers worked and his didn't. She couldn't have gotten to work by cheating. People were in a different room. It showed there was something really going on. The fact that his didn't work, I think, simply showed he wasn't trying very hard or his sceptical attitude interfered with his own performance. Anyway, the sense of being stared at seems to be real. It happens with animals too. Animals can tell when people are looking at them and people can tell when animals are looking at them. And I think it evolved in the context of predator-prey relationships. I think in any, maybe hundreds of millions of years old, the eye first evolved about, I think it was about 350 million years ago. And as soon as predators with eyes began to be able to look at prey, if prey animals could detect when a predator was looking at them, a hidden predator was looking at them, they'd have a better chance of escaping than if they couldn't detect it. So I think this is a basic, normal, not paranormal, natural, not supernatural ability. Been surprisingly ignored by psychical researchers, but it is, I think, within the sphere of psychical research. Much more information on this in my book, The Sense of Being Stared At and Other Aspects of the Extended Mind. Now, I now want to turn to telepathy, because this is another aspect of the extended mind. Animals within social groups are bonded with each other and they have to coordinate their activity. If you look at flocks of starlings or other birds, they can fly together and change direction in an astonishingly coordinated way without bumping into their neighbours, and do it very fast. So can schools of fish. The best computer models of this treat the whole group as a field, a bit like a magnetic field affecting iron filings. I think these are field phenomena. I think social groups have extended fields. My own theory is they're morphic fields, but I'm not this evening, I don't have time to go into my own particular theory. All I need to say really in this context is that if members of social groups are linked or bonded through fields in some way, then this connection still connects them even when they move apart. When wolf packs, when the adults go hunting and leave the cubs in the den, the field that joins the young and the old is stretched, not broken. They remain connected, they remain bonded. It's a bit like in quantum theory. If two particles have been part of the same system and they move apart, they remain entangled or connected at a distance. So changing one instantly affects the other. This was something Einstein didn't like about quantum theory. He said if it was true, it would allow for what he called spooky action at a distance. But experiments show quantum theory is true, and Einstein was wrong. It really does happen. I think these phenomena where members of social groups that have interacted remain in contact at a distance is analogous to quantum non-locality, which doesn't fall off with distance. Neither does telepathy. And I think this connection between members of bonded groups that still connects them at a distance through a social field is the basis of telepathy. A changing one can affect the other. I think it's a normal, not paranormal, natural, not supernatural, way in which members of social groups are connected in animals and in people. But we're not special. I think we have telepathic abilities because of our social nature as animals. Because I think this is basically an animal ability, I did my own studies principally on animals. Very little psychical research has been done with animals, but I started with the ones we know best, dogs and cats and horses and parrots. And some of you may have seen my book, Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, in which I summarise the result of years of research with dogs and cats and parrots and horses and other animals, looking at their telepathic connections as well as their sense of direction and precognitive abilities. Animals are often very telepathic with their owners. I've built up a database of more than 5,000 cases of people where people think their animals being influenced by their thought or intention. In the case of cats, for example, many cat owners think their cat knows when they're planning to take it to the vet. It disappears. And we've done a survey of vets, and this is a huge problem for vets. People are always missing appointments because they can't find the cat. However hard they try not to give the cat clues, it still seems to pick it up. But the easiest to test of these abilities is animals, dogs and cats, that know when their owners are coming home. Their owner is miles away. They can't read body language, subtle cues. Very often they do it 10 minutes or more in advance, even when people come home at non-routine times in unfamiliar vehicles. And I've done a whole series of experiments on this. We film the place the dog waits the whole time the person's out. We have them come home at randomly selected times they don't know in advance. We ring them up to tell them when to go home. They don't know in advance when they're going. The people at home don't know when they're coming, or sometimes there is no one at home. And to avoid familiar car sounds, in our most rigorous experiments, they travel by taxi, a different one each time. And the dog still knows. We have it on film over and over and over again. I've published papers on this, and indeed on the sense of being stared at. They're all on my website for free, so you can look up the details if you're interested in the statistics and all that. But it's a highly significant statistical effect. So I think dogs really know when their owners are coming home, and I think telepathy among humans works in a very similar way. Because I'm a biologist, primarily, I come to this from looking at the natural history. And I have a database of thousands of cases of human telepathy, too. And one of the most biological is where it occurs between mothers and babies. Many mothers have found when they're breastfeeding that when they go back to work after the baby's a few months old, they still breastfeed in the evenings, but they're away from the baby more and more. Many of them have found that they can be away from their baby and it's not a normal feeding time, and they suddenly feel their breast tingling, their milk lets down. Now, for the benefit of the men in the room, the milk let down reflex is mediated by the hormone oxytocin. Normally it happens when a mother hears the baby cry or feels the touch of the baby. And it's a hormone-mediated response. It causes the breast to squeeze out milk. The nipples start leaking. Many women feel their breast tingle when this happens. Now, if a mother's just working, or if she's shopping or something, suddenly her milk lets down, most mothers just assume their baby needs them. And for centuries, maybe millennia, they just went home. Now they ring home on a mobile phone, and they're usually right. I did a study on breastfeeding mothers in North London, 20 mothers over a two-month period each, and we found that the correlation between the letdown of the milk and the baby's distress was way, way above chance. The odds against it being a chance coincidence were 1 billion to 1, and this is more significant than the existence of the Higgs boson. This is a very natural form of telepathy. Most mothers have this even when their children are older. They know when they've had an accident or when they're sad or in distress. But the milk let down one is easy to do to study experimentally. It would be a great project for someone in a nursing college or studying midwifery because it's quite easy to do. Most nursing mothers are very interested in it. In fact, most of them take it for granted. In my the parapsychologists, on the whole, work on very artificial situations. The Ganzfeld, you know, people lying in dim red light with half ping pong balls over their eyes. Well, how many of us do that in real life? Probably very few. Certainly I don't. So I try and start from things that do happen in real life. And the one that's the commonest of all kinds of telepathy in the modern world is telephone telepathy. You think of someone for no apparent reason. Then they ring, and you say, "That's funny, I was just thinking about you." Or when the phone rings, before you pick it up or look at the caller ID, you just know who it is. I've done surveys on this in various countries, Britain, Germany, North America, South America, and on average about 80% of the population say they've had this experience, compared with about 50 or 60% who've had other kinds of telepathic experience. In all countries, more women than men have had this kind of experience, but the average of it's at just over 80% means that certainly most people have had this. How many people here have had these kinds of experiences with phone calls? Yes, well, I'd say about 80 or 90%. So this is a perfectly normal sample of the Glasgow population. That's reassuring. So this has been going on ever since telephones were invented. So what do sceptics have to say about this? Well, you know what they have to say because you've heard it yourself. You know, so, well, it may appear to be telepathy, but you know, you just have a very hazy idea of statistics, and it's just a coincidence, and it happens every so often, but you just forget the millions of times you're wrong. So it's just coincidence and selective memory. It's not really telepathy at all. That's what they always say. Or, if you know someone well, you know their, unconsciously know their patterns of life, so you can anticipate when they're going to ring you, unconsciously. The trouble with that is, of course, you can't prove that it's really going on if it's unconscious. And if it is unconscious, it could be telepathic anyway. But the first one is a statistical argument. And when people say that to me, I now say, well, where are your data? You know, it's all right to have a hypothesis, but where are the data? Until recently, no one had done any experiments whatever on this extraordinarily common phenomenon. They have no data. It's an evidence-free speculation. We need data in science, not just speculations, armchair skeptical speculations. I've now done tons of experiments on telephone telepathy, and I'm going to show you one now. If we could... in my experiments, basically, I have... the subject has four callers. We pick one of the four at random by the throw of a die. We ring them up and ask them to call the subject. They're being filmed with a landline telephone. They have to guess when the phone rings which of the four callers it is, and they have to say it before they pick the phone up. I think it's John. They pick it up. Hello, John. They're right or they're wrong. By chance, they'd be right 25% of the time. What we're going to see here is an experiment done with... I've done many of these experiments.
You have to log it, Chris. Password. What is it? Okay, it's... That was PK, by the way.
I've done a lot of these with perfectly obscure subjects, and they're all published in my in journals, and they're on my website. But the television wanted to do one with television for television, and they said it's no use having ordinary people. This is television. We need celebrities. So I told them they had to be people who know each other well. Telepathy typically works between people who are closely bonded. And they came up with the Nolan sisters. Who were a 1980s girl band. And so here you're going to see one of these experiments done with the Nolan sisters.
If you look at the modern world, despite all discouragement, most people believe that they've had telepathic experience. And interestingly, the most common counterfactual in the modern world is precisely one that's grown out of non-science technologies. In other words, telepathy connected with telephone calls.
So many people tell stories of telephone telepathy that Dr. Sheldrake devised a test to see whether someone could predict who, out of four people, was calling them. The probability of being correct by guess or learn was 25%.
We've now completed 1,000 of these trials, and the average success rate is 42%, which is hugely significant statistically. People certainly aren't right every time, but it's way above what you'd expect by chance.
So, is telephone telepathy real, or is it just a figment of the imagination? We brought one of the most successful girl bands of the 80s to London to find out. The Nolan sisters are one of the closest families in showbiz. At the height of their fame, they spent months on the road together, and most of them still live within miles of each other. But how well will they do in the telephone telepathy test?
Could you tell me all your names and all the
truths? I'm Denise Nolan, I'm the most intelligent one.
I'm Maureen, she's just Maureen.
Hi, I'm Linda, and Denise is alive.
I'm Colleen.
Colleen is the youngest, and I'm the eldest.
Why do you say that?
Because. Oh, what you said?
The first stage of the experiment is to decide which of the sisters will be the receiver.
So four of you are going to stay here, one of you is going to go to the hotel and try and guess which of the others is phoning. So we've got to pick the person to do that.
It's got to be Colleen.
Colleen is nominated by her sisters because she's the youngest. And while she's driven a mile away to the other location, Dr. Sheldrake allocates each of the other sisters a number between 1 and 4. For each time, a throw of the dice will determine who will be the caller.
So we're going to start now with the first one. I'm going to throw a die. 2. The so we're going to have 2 numbers.
Maureen's first up, and the rest of the group must leave the room to allow her to focus. When the phone rings, Colleen will have to say who she thinks is calling before she picks up.
Right. Maureen. Maureen.
Yes! Oh, yes! Yes! Thank you for that.
Thank you. Lovely talking to you.
Just a coincidence. Next up is Anne, the only skeptic among the sisters.
Denise.
No, I'm wrong.
With four sisters to choose from, if it's purely guesswork, Colleen should expect to be right 25% of the time by the end of the experiment.
Think of your favourite sister. The most talented one. More than anything now. Linda.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
scaring them now. They're back in that room.
They should never have gone in there with you.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Bye. Wow. Kalima's final score is 50%, one of the highest of over 1,000 tests conducted by Dr. Sheldrake.
Anyway, well done, and that was great.
I now have an automated version of this experiment running on mobile telephones, and I invite any of you to try it for yourselves. If you go to my website, sheldrake.org, and you go to the online experiments portal, you'll find some of the mobile telephone telepathy test. You enter your own mobile phone number and your name, and in this case you have two callers. You put in their names and their mobile phone numbers. The computer then picks one of the two at random, sends them a text message asking them to call you at a landline number, which is in the message. That's the computer. So you call the person through the computer. The computer puts you on hold, and it then rings the subject. Their phone says telephone telepathy test, the caller ID, and it says, this is the telephone telepathy test. One of your callers is on the line right now waiting to speak to you. Please guess who it is. Press 1 for Anne. Press 2 for Bill. And they guess, and it opens up, and so they get instant feedback. And then after a minute it cuts off because I'm paying for the call. And after a random time delay it happens again, so they've done 6 trials, and then everyone gets a text message saying, thanks for taking part, the subject scored 4 out of 6 or whatever. In this case, obviously the chance level's 50%. The hit rate's running around 60%. It's not a huge effect, but it's very significant indeed. And this is testing people of all levels of ability. Some people are much better than others. I asked the sceptics to check out this test to make sure there's no flaw in it. Chris French ran it himself, with himself as a subject. He's the editor, or was the editor, of the Sceptic magazine. You often see him on TV as the studio sceptic. And Chris French thinks the method's fine, no problem with the method or the statistics. The only problem is that when he did the test, instead of getting the chance levels 3 out of 6, he's the only person who's ever got 0 out of 6. Significantly, well, not significantly, but way below chance. And I said to him, Chris, this is not a random or a chance result. And he said, no. Well, he said, my friends are always telling me I'm a psychic in denial. This method is up and running. It's a great basis for a student project. If any of you know any students looking for a project, tell them about it. And I even have a research helper program where they can work with me on the project and even get paid for doing it. So if any of you are interested yourselves, email me through my website and we can discuss taking this further. This now makes it very easy to do serious, proper telepathy research outside of the laboratory, just using ordinary mobile phones in real life. When I gave a talk on this research at Google, there was a tremendous interest there. There's a lot of interest now in Silicon Valley about developing apps for mobile phones, intuition training apps, based on some of my tests. And I don't think it'll be long before these become a reality. I think when that happens, the telepathy will just be out there as part of ordinary life. It already is. But scientific tests for it will be readily available. They already are, but most people don't know about them. Anyway, I think that in conclusion, the 10 dogmas of modern science, which I've outlined, lead to this closed, constricted worldview and this kind of dogmatic response that those of us in psychical research are only too familiar with. We've all encountered it. It's kind of unthinking, irrational dogmatism in the name of science and reason. Well, I'm all in favour of science and reason as long as they're scientific and rational. And unfortunately, a lot of sceptics are not, because they're They're fundamentalist materialists who believe all these dogmas are not just opinions or hypotheses or assumptions, but they think they're the truth. And if they're the truth, then psychic phenomena must be impossible, all the evidence must be flawed, and that's why they don't waste time looking at it. They know the truth already. That's the trouble with dogmas and with true believers and fundamentalists. But I think as these dogmas are questioned in different areas of science, it will have a liberating effect on all of science, not just on psychical research. And I think the day when is not far off when the subject of our investigations becomes just part of normal psychology. I don't like the word parapsychology myself, because it means para means beyond. It means beyond psychology, or paranormal means beyond the normal. I think these things are normal. They're natural. In fact, if you ever have arguments with skeptics who use that annoying argument, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof, try this one out on them. I tried it out on Richard Dawkins with great effect. He says, you know, you're talking about telephone telepathy, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof. So I said, well, Richard, what's the extraordinary claim? I said, 80% of the population say they've had this experience. It's not extraordinary, it's ordinary. It's very, very ordinary. The extraordinary claim is that 80% of the population are deluded about their own experience. And where's your evidence for that? Of course, he had none at all, apart from generic arguments about the fallibility of human judgment. Anyway, I think as we move beyond these 10 dogmas, as we open up science to scientific questioning, if in the spirit of radical scepticism, a scepticism that looks at its own assumptions, I think science will be liberated. I think it will become freer, more interesting, more fun, and probably cheaper too. Thank you.
Timed, because you've left us time for a few questions. Any questions?
Well, in the ones that the Nolan that I talked about, we've done about 1,000 altogether.
Yeah, but for these, how many calls do you do?
Oh, with each person. With the automated one, we do 6 calls per subject. With the other non-automated ones, we did 10 calls per subject. So we do, each subject would have a session in which they do 10 calls, and we sometimes retested subjects. But with the film telephone telepathy tests, we did several hundred trials. So the p-value, the probability value for the results we were getting was 1 × 10⁻⁹. I mean, this is a hugely significant effect, because of it, we had a large sample size. Let me just say one more thing. We've done very similar experiments with emails, SMS messages, and internet telepathy-based tests. We get very similar results with text messages and with emails. So this is not just telephone calls, it's all similar. And those, the sample sizes on those tests were all in the hundreds, you know, up to 800, 900. So these are very large samples with highly significant results. Yes. The question is, yes, what about cognitive behavioural therapy in the context of medicine? Well, that's a very, very interesting question, actually, because that's one of the areas where this dogma about the purely materialist thing is crumbling. And the reason it's crumbling is because the cognitive behavioural therapists have rather cleverly done scientific tests that show that it works. And what they've shown is that it can work better for certain conditions than long doses of antipsychotic or drugs or tranquilizers or whatever. So I think this is one of the areas which is particularly interesting because of the methods that were used. You see, right now in medical research, the so-called gold standard of medical research is the double-blind placebo-controlled trial, where you have patients given a blank drug compared with a placebo, and you find out if the blank, the new drug, whether it works better than the placebo. In other words, whether it works better than nothing. Well, very often they don't, because you get huge placebo effects, which itself is unexplained within conventional medicine. Why is the mind, the expectations of the mind, having such a big effect? It ought not to. Until recently, the placebo effect was regarded as a nuisance in clinical trials. Now people are realizing it's very interesting in its own right, and it plays a major part even in ordinary medicine. My view, and which I suggest in my book, is that the best way of doing medical research is not double-blind placebo-controlled trials, but outcome studies, where you just see what works in a theory-neutral way. You compare, if you have people with depression, you send some of them to cognitive behavioral therapists, you send some of them to psychiatrists, and you send some of them to anyone else who claims to be able to cure it. And then you simply find out what percentage get better. And then you can see which methods work best and which will work cheapest as well. Cognitive behavioural therapy in outcome studies was shown to work better and cheaper, which is why it's there on the National Health Service. And interestingly, they're now even prescribing mindfulness meditation on the NHS, because that's been shown to work in outcome studies. So it's actually the psychotherapies that are leading the way in the research methodology of outcome research. We should have that in all branches of medicine. In drug studies, as Ben Goldacre says in his new book, Bad Pharma, which is scepticism being very well applied, I think. He started off as being an annoying kind of narrow sceptic. He's now moved on to bigger targets, pharmaceutical companies. And I think what he shows there is to be much better in drug trials, not to prove that a new drug works better than nothing, but to have a test where you compare a new drug with the established generic cheaper drug, like an established statin or an established antipsychotic or whatever, and see whether it works better than the established cheaper drug. That's what we really need to know. If it's no better than that, there's no reason the NHS should pay large amounts for a new patent drug if the established generic ones work as well or better. But they're not doing that research yet, but that's the way it should go, as he and I both agree.
Couple of quick questions.
It's well known that there are many people who had organ transplants who have memories of the donor. I'm interested to know if in your book you're discussing mind and memory, and are the fields associated with the mind resident in other organs in our body?
Yes, interesting question. What I say in my book, I didn't discuss it this evening really, is that I don't think memories are stored in the brain. I think the brain's like a receiver, they come by morphic resonance from the past. The reason we have our own memories, we're more similar to ourselves in the past than to anyone else. But we are similar to other people, so we have a kind of collective memory as well. So I don't think memories are in the brain. And when you have a heart transplant and people have memories of the life of the donor, I don't think the memories are in the heart either. What I think happens is that the heart, like the brain, acts as a kind of tuner or receiver and tunes in to the memories of that person who's now dead, retrieving memories. I don't think they're physically stored in the heart any more than they're physically stored in the brain. But that heart is a receiver for them because it's part of that body and connects in with that dead person.
I may have a question again.
Firstly, thank you so much for that wonderful talk. It really inspired it. There seems to be a correlation between somebody who is sceptical and the result coming out as a negative. So do you believe that the beliefs or the pre-awareness of a group of scientists could augment the results of an experiment, not through the numbers being fudged or anything like that, but actually just the belief that they're bringing to the table?
Yes. In fact, it's well established in all branches, well, in psychology and in parapsychology, that there are experimentary effects. The experimenter's expectation and beliefs affect the result you get. A clear case I mentioned already, Marilyn Schlitz and Richard Wiseman do the same experiment with randomly assigned students as subjects. She gets a positive, significant result. He doesn't. It's clearly to do with the experimenter. In her case, she thought it was possible. She was nice to the subject. She really concentrated on them, sent them loving thoughts during the looking sessions. He was bored by the whole thing and thought it was a waste of time, didn't look very hard. And so it's easy to see how it could come about. But there are many examples in psychology where people's expectations affect what they observe. That's why many experiments are done blind in psychology and in medicine and parapsychology. Oddly enough, in the so-called hard sciences, people don't take this into account at all. I did a survey of the use of blind methods, which would guard against experimental effects, in the different sciences. In physics, 0% were done blind, chemistry 0%, biology 0.4%, psychology about 15%, medicine about 20%, parapsychology about 85%. Parapsychology is much the most rigorous of the sciences. And I think that I proposed an experiment, actually, I mentioned it in this book, in regular science, say in a chemistry practical or a biochemistry practical in a university, half the students would do it the normal way, where this is the activated enzyme, the inhibited enzyme. They know they're meant to find the activated ones more active than the inhibited one, and they do, usually. But the other half of the class would do it blind, A and B. They wouldn't know which was which. If you do a statistical analysis at the end, is there any difference between the two groups? I think there would be, and I think my prediction would be that those who did it blind wouldn't get so much difference as those who knew which was which. But I haven't been able to persuade anyone to do this experiment because it would just be too much dynamite. I almost persuaded the head of physics at a major public school to do it, but then he told me the head of science wanted to meet me, so I went to a meeting of the whole science staff. I explained it, and the head of science said, "Well, of course the students are going to get the results they expect." He said, "That's what a science education is all about." He said, "You've got to learn to get the right results, otherwise you'll get nowhere in science." And he said, "And of course your experiment will work, but if it does, it'll open a can of worms, and I don't want it opened in my school."
I'm a student of philosophy, and we have a very open department at Glasgow Uni, so I would really love to connect with you and maybe have a look at that. I'm doing philosophy of science and philosophy of mind.
Oh, do, yes, indeed. You can contact me through my website. If you do email me, they keep it short because I get hundreds. It's really hard to cope. Take a look at the book, though, because I cover a lot of these issues in this book.
The last question, and perhaps a brief answer in it.
I don't know if it's going to be a brief. I've been following the recent fun you've been having with the TEDx controversy yourself and Graham Hancock. And
yes.
Probably some people might need this a brief intro as to what's going on, but I'd be grateful for an update or a commentary on your experiences.
Okay, it will take about 3 minutes, four maybe. Okay, there's an American organisation called TED. It's a kind of media corporation, and they have conferences where they have people give 18-minute talks and covering a wide range of subjects. I no doubt some of you have seen these online. I was asked to speak in one in London in January, a TEDx talk, which is a kind of franchised TED Talks. It was at an event called Challenging Existing Paradigms, and I gave an 18-minute talk on the science delusion. Well, it went up online on the TED website. Everything was fine. 35,000 people viewed it. But then my talk was denounced by two militant atheist bloggers in the United States, Jerry Coyne and P.Z. Myers, who are both Dawkinsite-type biologists, who denounced TED. They said that they'd discredited their organization by giving me a platform to promote pseudoscience. Everything I said was pseudoscience. It was factually completely wrong. Everything was shot through with error. It was full of misleading statements, and they totally discredited the TED platform. So the TED people were bullied by these people, and they took my talk down. And then later they picked on Graham Hancock, and they took his down too, because they said his was pseudoscience as well. Well, this led to a huge outcry on the internet. Within a day or two, pirate versions of my talk were on at least 12 other sites all over the internet. And the TED people then had to justify it, so they issued a statement from their science board, an anonymous science board, stating about the pseudoscience factual errors. They picked out a few points from the lecture. It was very easy to refute these. They were completely wrong. And when they published my response on their website, And they actually deleted the Science Board statement because I'd shown that it was actually false, what they had said. It was easy to refute. They reinstated my talk in a kind of naughty corner of the internet with a kind of health warning, this is pseudoscience. But that didn't work because there were huge protests. The comments were running about 10-1 in my favour and in Hancock's favour. The TED people were terribly embarrassed. Their brand was being damaged. They were accused of censorship, you know, narrow thinking, you know, promoting an atheist agenda and so forth. Then they kept moving new blogs and stuff, trying to shake off the controversy. We kept following them. It ended up that this talk of mine's had more comments than any other talk that's ever been on any TED platform. And the number of viewings is now well over 500,000 on these rogue websites, compared with 35,000 before they tried to ban it. And so the result, it was then taken up by the Independent on Sunday with a whole lot of it went on to the Huffington Post. Deepak Chopra put a lead article in the Huffington Post in America, an online newspaper, which led to a huge amount more comments. The head of TED, who's called Chris Anderson, then had to write a blog trying to defend it, but he was totally attacked by everyone. And then a statement was issued by 19 different scientists on a blog on the Huffington Post saying that they supported what I was doing. This was part of the new emerging area of consciousness studies, which was what was going to transform the sciences. And the TED people were just on the wrong side of history and haven't picked up what's happening. There's a major paradigm shift, they said, going on. One of these men is a Harvard professor. I mean, these are eminent American academics. 19 of them came out of the closet and stood up. And this happened about a week ago. So since then, it's been taken up by more newspapers and so on. Anyway, the talk's still available on the internet. It's actually done me a good turn, I think, because it's far more people know about it now than they would have done otherwise. And the other thing is that these militant atheists then attacked a TEDx event that was happening in Hollywood last week because they saw Marilyn Schlitz was speaking and Larry Dossey, who writes on spiritual effects in medicine, he's a doctor. They said that was pseudoscience too. So they suppressed, they withdrew their license from this TEDx Hollywood event. At a week's notice, the organisers were left in the lurch. They decided to go ahead anyway. They called it X-TEDx. And now there's a big debate on the internet that there ought to be a set of really open-minded events, not subject to the kind of censorship TED's now imposing. And someone suggested a whole new series of events which would be called INSTED. So they're now in a kind of damage limitation mode, the TED people. They've had a rough time, and Chris Anderson rang me up personally and tried to find a way forward, and we had actually quite a good chat for about an hour. And I said to him, look, you really need to move on because, you know, you're being dominated and bullied by people who stand for the most reactionary kind of science, and most of your audience want to go on beyond that, and you'll damage your reputation. But by then they'd already done it. I think if I'd talked to him before, I don't think they would have done it. I think he greatly regrets it. But he can't turn back now, and they've committed themselves to this disastrous course for them. So anyway, I think things are opening up fast. And one spin-off from this is that a group of people who were engaged in that controversy are now getting an organisation together to try and deal with the Wikipedia problem. The sceptics have organised groups online of trolls and bloggers and people who've set it as their goal for the last 4 or 5 years to make sure that Wikipedia and online information sources are dominated by the sceptical viewpoint. So ESP and parapsychology, for example, are classified on Wikipedia as pseudoscience. If anyone tries to alter it on Wikipedia, the sceptics get an instant alert and they get down on and they force it back into their pseudoscience. So there's now a plan to try and clean up Wikipedia and have a kind of, if necessary, blogs about it and flush out into the open the distortion that's been going on through these sceptical online activists. And I think there's a good chance of success. It'll be a battle, but let's watch out for this. This is being planned now on a daily basis. I'm in on the kind of email group that's planning this. And I think it's long overdue. So there might be some good spin-offs from all this too.
Thank you. I have a brief announcement of two or three things that I would wish you to know before you leave. But this is the appropriate juncture, not at the very end, to say that you may not have escaped from the reaction of biologists, because although we have not, by tradition, had a formal vote of thanks at the end of this lecture, usually for reasons of time, the name of the lecture has changed, so let's bring the vote of thanks back. Stephen is a former biologist, and he does have something he wants to say.
You've covered so much, Dr. Sheldrake.
Take the microphone.
You've covered so much, it's difficult to know where to start. Let me first of all say to everybody, really, that I've had the advantage of having read quite a lot of the book, and it's, well, as you will realise from what we've heard tonight, it's fascinating stuff. There's, of course, a vast deal more than Dr. Sheldrake's had time to look at. And if you found, I mean, I guess that some of you may have found the first two subjects a bit difficult, and if you do, you'll find, you know, lots more explained in this this book, indeed, a marvellous book. I think it covers so much. You started off, of course, I mean, you with talking about how the conservation of matter and the conservation of energy, how these things aren't necessarily true, and laws of nature. I love, actually, an example you give in your book about a rather big exception to the conservation of matter, and that is the Big Bang.
Yes.
Which, of course, is absolutely so. You know, this extraordinary exception. Everything apparently came into existence in one shot. So clearly the conservation of matter can't be an absolute rule for all occasions. I found extremely interesting myself there. I'm sure everyone else did. Your talk here about your own work on telepathy and so on. I was very interested in one thing, which I think I suddenly understood more now, because I am puzzled. I mean, I don't understand really your thesis that the mind is sort of outside the brain. I'm one of those people who would tend to say that what we are seeing is actually inside our brain in some sense. But what struck me tonight was I didn't realise that your view that in some way we are certainly projecting outwards what we see, that this ties up with your very interesting work on the sense of being stared at. This could sort of explain that. So light was dawning on me in that way. I found that very interesting. It's almost a joke that I can take from your book is one of your encounters with Richard Dawkins. I love this little exchange. This was when, in fact, Dawkins and Sheldrake are having a discussion in what is supposed to be a programme about your work. You are discovering that, in fact, there's going to be no discussion of evidence, which there was supposed to be, which I think Dawkins, or the representative of the television firm,
yeah,
that was organising this programme and had asked you to take part, had said, no, they didn't want to discuss the evidence, there wasn't time for it. And then you say to Dawkins, you weren't interested, you made clear, you weren't interested in taking part in a low-grade... what's the term you use?
Debunking exercise.
A low-grade debunking exercise, to which Dawkins replies, it's not a low-grade debunking exercise, it's a high-grade debunking exercise, which seems to be very high. But, of course, it's a very serious matter, because, I mean, it is quite absurd that people... I have the highest respect for Dawkins. I think he's a terrific writer on biology and so on. But you are helping to make clear how there is a blank spot here. And also, of course, Lewis Wolpert,
yes,
who has spoken, who simply denies it. You've told us, I think, when we're having a debate with him and he about telepathy, and he just ignored all your evidence. It does strike me that you are doing a very, very important job in trying to fight the battle against this prejudice in the scientific world which many of us, I'm sure, will be aware of, but it's also well worth reading that book for this reason. But anyway, thank you for an enormously interesting lecture. Thank you very much.
Thank you.